सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम टू सोच विचार।
थैंक यू।
वी ऑफन डिस्कस्ड रेंट सीकिंग, ग्रोथ, डेवलपमेंट। टुडे आई एम हैप्पी टू टेल यू दैट आई हैव समबडी हु कैन कंबाइन दीज थ्री कॉन्सेप्ट्स एंड टॉक अबाउट इट। आई हैव विद मी मिस्टर शाहिद अहमद। He is a well-known economist from Pakistan who has worked in the central bank as well as various commercial banks as an economist, and he's also worked in the UN, spent a large part of his career in the UN. Well-known economist, as I said, he's been teaching economics too, and he's just written a very provocative book which is worth looking at, which is called Rentier Capitalism. The subtitle, which he'll explain himself. So welcome to Soch Pachar, Mr. Shahid Ahmed.
Thank you.
Shahid Sahib, can you please first clarify the title of your book? I've forgotten the second part of the title of the book.
Yeah, the second part is Disorganized Development and Social Injustice in Pakistan.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's lovely. Beautiful. So can you, I know it's unfair to ask an author to do that, but for the sake of our audience, can you describe what the central thesis of your book is and what are the salient points that you want to introduce the audience to, and then hopefully this will attract people to read the book?
Hopefully, I'll be able to summarize this over the next 2 or 3 minutes, mm-hmm. and I'm very glad to be able to do so. Mm-hmm. I must tell you a little bit about how this title came about. Mm-hmm. My original title was a little bit tame. It was at the suggestion of the publisher, mm-hmm. that we need something more eye-catching when people look for books on Pakistan on the internet, mm-hmm. and that the first part was essentially the doing of the publisher. Now, the background to this book, I need a few minutes to explain, mm-hmm. is that when I was in the UN, we used to, there was a kind of South Asian group, mm-hmm. which used to meet over lunch, over, mm-hmm. you know, a cup of tea or over coffee every now and then. Mm-hmm. And one of the perpetual subjects which came up for discussion, mm-hmm. was that how had East Asia and Southeast Asia done so much better than us in South Asia, mm-hmm. over the last, let's say, you know, between the mid-1980s to the time that I left the UN, which was in early 2005. And there used to be many different explanations of why this had happened and why South Asia had got left behind. And so many people suggested to me that since I had retired in 2005, I should go back and attempt a book on the subject. And that is how this book came about. If you divide Asia into three broad sub-regions, there is South Asia, then there is Southeast Asia, and then there is East Asia. And all three have had a very different growth experience since the 1950s. And my book basically tries to trace how the different sub-regions have fared and why they have fared differently.
You're basically contrasting our region with the rest of Asia and saying how things have transpired differently. Okay, fair
That's
enough.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And there are two or three fairly fundamental things which I can, you know, bring to your attention straight away. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at the success of these two regions other than South Asia, which is East Asia and Southeast Asia, it is that their success has not been accidental. It's been based on good government policies. And the first policy that I would mention is land reform. Now, many people mistake land reform as breaking up large estates. But there is a second side to land reform, mm-hmm. which is to make the rural economy more productive. And so, therefore, the problem of rural poverty has to be the focus of attention in the early stages of development. And this is what happened in both East Asia and Southeast Asia. The second main ingredient of their growth experience, I should also mention, is that they invested heavily in public goods at the beginning of development. You know, which is large investments in education, large investments in public health, and then large investments also in infrastructure. As their economies grew more productive, the state was able to command resources for investments in roads, in ports, in energy. Almost completely diametrically opposed to the kinds of problems that Pakistan came up against from the 1990s onwards. And finally, I think they paid very close attention to international competitiveness. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, they were able to follow this export-led growth. And as you know, Nadeem, anyone, that both East Asia and Southeast Asia have been spectacularly successful in that area.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So basically you're saying that there are four elements. One is agricultural productivity combined with land reforms or led by land reforms. And secondly, there is infrastructure development. Then thirdly, there's public goods development. And fourthly, there is export-led development. Now, I would argue, maybe I'm correct me if I'm wrong, just for the sake of the interviewer should argue for against this argument. Let me just say that almost every one of our government policies that I've seen, plans and everything, has argued for all four of these. And if I talk to the PMLN and government, they'll say, hey, we built all the infrastructure in the world and we've been trying to export like mad. We signed this treaty, that treaty, free trade agreements, and we've gone ahead and begged everybody to take our exports. We've signed CPEC. So we've been trying to do all this, and we've been trying to fix agriculture for a long time. And everybody is trying to, they're trying to put IT into public service delivery. So they are doing a lot of things. So does that mean the future looks bright for us?
You know, Nadeem, I completely agree with you that if you look at the history of Pakistan, even over the long term, and more especially over the last few years, that all governments have said all these things. Mm-hmm. It's the problem has arisen in not having let's say the kind of, you know, sort of policy package which delivers results on the ground. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go back to the different land reforms that Pakistan has attempted. The first land reform was actually attempted during the time of Ayub Khan, if not even before.
Right.
And to the best of my knowledge, not a single acre of land was actually taken over from any of the big landlords, and none of the other supporting packages, a package of policies in order to make the rural economy more productive were ever implemented in a sensible way. I'll give you one example. You see, there was a big problem with waterlogging and salinity in those days. And meanwhile, we were trying to make a substitute for the canal system that had been left in the eastern part of Punjab, which became India, and we were trying to build these link canals, which I think were done with World Bank assistance, sure. to have the same quantity of water that we previously had access to before the Indus Waters Treaty came. But beyond that, you know, like extension services, like easy credit to the small farmer, like easy market arrangement, sure, for their goods to be brought to local areas. You know, our mandi towns, when they were built before partition, were there to cater to an area which roughly lay within a diameter of about 30 kilometers from each mandi town. Mm. But mandi towns were captured by the big landlords after partition. And they would not allow the small landholder or the small cultivator.
But Shahid, now the agricultural census tells us, if I'm right, that the average landholding, especially in Punjab and I think most of Frontier, etc., is now almost 5 acres per farm.
If not, yeah, absolutely. Right? That is what it has become. And that actually, Nadeem, that has not been the result of a conscious policy of land reform. That is just intergenerational.
Agreed. But we've got now small land holdings. So in a sense, what land reform wanted to do has been done. So would that, presage an increase in productivity or not?
No, there has been no increase in productivity because the ratio of the number of people cultivating each acre of land has actually deteriorated because of very fast population growth.
Okay.
The other problem is that if you contrast your experience of the 1950s and 1960s with, let's say, East Punjab, there was a land reform in East Punjab. And one of the outcomes of that land reform was to make the land much more productive. You may be able to go back and see the figures for the 1960s and 1970s, where wheat yields and sugarcane yields in East Punjab actually improved dramatically compared to our part of the Punjab. However, what has happened more recently is that yields seem to have flattened out even in East Punjab. And that is one of the problems that both East and West Punjab are facing, which is the overuse of fertilizer. Now, here I will come to the lack of good extension services. Our farmer have never had access to good advice, nor good support services like easier credit availability.
But Shahid, the problem there that I see is that in a sense, we get into a circularity because if small sizes don't matter, and then of course we move on to good extension, we move on to this, to let's say credit, or we move on to water. Yes, obviously things are lacking. And as you said, East Punjab productivity also flattened out. And if you take East Punjab productivity contrasted to China, East Punjab is much lower than China. Productivity differs across the world. So, I mean, I'm just thinking in terms of making an analysis. The way I would look at it is, yes, there is something lacking, agreed. I'm not saying there isn't. Yes, market development is very, very poor in Pakistan. And yes, there is all kinds of government intervention as well as private sector market failures involved. And I'm trying to put my finger on it. Where do we go in terms of what your title is, Rentier Capitalism? Why do you call the book Rentier Capitalism?
I think that we come to our a kind of sort of aborted attempts at industrialization and almost like leapfrogging into services like financial services. And financial services, Nadeem, you will know this as well as anyone, is that financial services have allowed this kind of rent seeking in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Number one, when the banks were in the private sector, they were owned by big business groups. When they were nationalized, vast loans were written off during the period, let's say the early 1980s and to the early 1990s when they were privatized again. The other problem that, this bank-led investment is that, the banks want their money back within 2 or 3 years because the nature of their deposits force them to do so. So the kind of long-term investments where, for instance, this example is not wholly appropriate. If you see the mid-sized German companies, which are called Mittelstand, they have been supported in the development of technology, in the development of new products, by state-owned banks, which are owned by the state government. And there is never a kind of time constraint that you need to start repaying loans after 3 years. And after 3 years, during those 3 years, the banks have actually capitalized interest as well.
But Shahid, I might remind you, and I think you remember that we had NDFC, PKK, and PIDC, we had a large number of development banks that had a mandate of doing exactly what you're saying, providing long-term loans, et cetera, even taking equity positions in companies. But somehow we failed to do anything with that, right? So what gives?
I think, you know, private investors, mm-hmm. and I'll give you a short example of very, mm-hmm. I mean, this will obviously not be representative of the whole class of our mm-hmm. private businessmen. But when I was in the BIM, mm-hmm. we discovered there were these big 33 big companies which were nationalized in 1972. Mm-hmm. And none of them actually had a proper balance sheet on which we could assess the either the viability of the business or what had, you know, the kind of sort of value addition that they had been doing. So our businessmen have always felt the need, you know, not to tell the whole story, and have, I think, been skimming off a bit of the you know, the kind of gross profits that these companies were generating and not reinvesting. And a lot of capital flight was taking place from these companies. So, I mean, my short answer, this may not be wholly representative of our business class, is that even in the 1960s, which is considered to be a kind of, you know, golden age of private sector development in manufacturing, we were not doing the things properly, and we were not completely honest with
Shahid, here I must ask you a question. I mean, when you say we, do you mean the industrialist? Do you mean the government? Do you mean the farmer? I mean, who is the we? Because the we began,
Nadeem, I'm oversimplifying, began with the your big textile owners.
Okay.
And then as you know, bureaucrats who were there also as partners, and since it was a kind of, you know, everything needed permission from some government agency, they unfortunately joined in this.
Fair enough. But let me step back a little. Shahid, you see, the point is, the way I look at it is that in the 50s and 60s, or let's start off with the Second World War. Post-Second World War is the time that developing economies were born thanks to American policy, where they tried to dismantle the British Empire. And right. Countries like ours were born, and then following us, African countries were born, and then following, you know, before that, even sort of East Asian countries were born. So kind of the developing world expanded out of that Second World War. But that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is that there was a growth industry led by people from various universities in the West that founded a subject called development economics, right?
Absolutely.
And then there was also the UN agency and the World Development World Bank and the International Monetary Fund that fueled with funding the development of development economics, right?
Right.
And
right.
If you're on the same page on that, then you will recall that to begin with, development economics was heavily influenced by central planning. Right? Central
Absolutely.
Planning
Absolutely.
Is something that
yeah.
every country, India followed the Mahalanobis model, the, you know, various countries followed central bank, the central planning models, and we had the two-gap model and the Harrod-Domar model, and we thought we had control of the economy, and it was only a financing problem. So we kind of, the whole development economists, people led by whoever, Hirschman or whoever the various development economists of the time were, they advocated this, and there was a lot of funding provided by the international agencies, and there was a one-size-fits-all that is still going on throughout the world, where the policies are given from the West, and we just implement them. And yes, we followed these policies, and we implemented them. So in that sense, every country virtually followed the same policy, some more successfully than others. And then we come to the Washington Consensus, when there was a time for rolling back those policies and developing more liberal policies, and we moved off in that direction. If we look at it that way, Pakistan has kind of followed the trend and all the policies that development economists have kind of given them. Now, what gives? Is it the fault of the development economists, or is it the fault of Pakistan? And if in Pakistan, who then?
You know, Nadeem, it's in my eyes, I think if you narrow the focus on Pakistan, which we know better than any other country, is that we see that you know, in the 1960s, rates of growth were good. distribution may not have been that good.
Yeah.
And even in terms of our international competitiveness, we were not that good, mm-hmm. bad.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think one of the problems that I have discussed in the book is that our growth was led by the textile industry, but at the same time, government followed a contradictory policy of keeping the exchange rate heavily overvalued.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons for that being that they needed to be able to import food, of which we were a deficit country, in order to get food at a relatively cheap price. Now, this had an adverse effect on our export competitiveness.
Sure.
You will remember, Nadeem, that we were experimenting with all kinds of, you know, this kind of export bonus voucher scheme in Peru,
sure.
which was, you know, the kind of haphazard way of devaluing the rupee for exporters.
Mm.
Now, unfortunately, if you take the whole package of policies, it was not working.
Mm.
And there was a study in the Pakistan Institute of Development Economics on the textile industry, that if you take all the subsidies together and if you take all the inputs together, that actually it was not managing to deliver any value addition, and that it might have been better to just export raw cotton the way that the things were.
Mm.
So, I mean, a lot of the effort that went in terms of development in the manufacturing sector was negated by this whole sort of paraphernalia of contradictory policies at the same time.
No, fair enough. But my question to you is that is correct, certainly. And I think that policy was followed in many countries, because I remember when I was working with the IMF, there was a long period in the 80s and 90s when we were correcting exchange rate systems in the world, moving on from dual exchange rates to single exchange rate and floating exchange rates. I think we spent almost a decade of 80s and even the 90s cleaning up exchange rate systems around the world. So Pakistan was not singular there. In the 60s, we kind of followed the Harvard Advisory Group model, which is a planning model. And then later on, Bhutto came along. And when Bhutto came along in 1973, there was a major devaluation. We kind of took care of the exchange rate problem. And yet, you know, exports picked up a little bit after that. But once again, we went into the same situation. So I'm just trying to get at what the fundamental problem is. We've been following international advice very well, I think. And yet we haven't developed. So what gives?
So, Nadeem, to put too fine a point on it, I think a private industrialist discovered that it was too difficult to compete with the outside world.
Okay.
And they got into bad habits, like having their loans rescheduled, like having, keeping a bit of the surplus they were generating from their investments in Pakistan. And a bit of capital flight became a bad habit.
Okay.
Now, I remember that with the Bhutto nationalizations, a lot of money must have gone out of Pakistan in those days. And if you contrast our experience, let's say with that of, if you take South Korea, in the early 1970s, its per capita income may not have been that much higher, or maybe even the same as ours.
Right.
And they were investing, and, you know, this General Park had just taken over. And I think that our business people turned out to be unequal to the task. And so the whole sort of, you know, vicious cycle of bad policies from the government, and then rent seeking, in which the bureaucrats became partners with the private sector, it just tended to make everything 10 times more difficult than it might have been.
Okay, so fair enough. So let's step back a little now. I hear what you're saying, and if I try and sort of kind of frame things from what I hear from you, what you're saying basically is that we have a situation where the private sector kind of got into an easy mode, both in the agricultural and the industrial sector, where the agricultural sector, they were able to capture the markets, they were able to capture the input markets, output markets, etc. They were able to engage through politics into all kinds of rent-seeking and self aggrandizement, self-profitable policies, and at the same time, the industrial sector started to benefit from the policy, and this was primarily because of the structure of governance and the structure of policy that we saw prevail. Then in that case, if I look at it that way, doesn't the whole thing come around to the structure of governance, that somehow there was something in the structure of governance that allowed both the landlords as well as the industrialists to take advantage of the structure of governance? And what I hear from you, what you're saying is the finger points at the bureaucracy. Do you want to elaborate on that? Tell me, how is it that they were able to capture the government?
You know, I mean, there are many, I would say that there are many reasons. You know, there is a kind of sort of implicit social contract in the way societies govern themselves. Mm-hmm. In the case of Pakistan, you know, our bureaucracy was never motivated by, you know, this kind of overarching national interest. They considered themselves to be successors to the old colonial bureaucrats. I mean, that is, I think, I mean, the fact, you know, Nadeem, I mean, this, that we are talking to each other in English, I can't think of any other country other than maybe India where such a discussion would be taking place in a foreign language. If you go to Thailand, if you have someone doing the kind of, you know, the soch bichar that you're doing, we would be discussing our problems in Thai, not in English.
Yeah.
So that is a kind of, you know, so...
But in most of Africa, we would still use a foreign language, either French or English.
Yeah, you know, Africa, again, you know, that their colonial experience may be very similar to ours, in which there is a tiny elite at the top of the social setup, which identifies itself completely with the colonial rulers.
Okay.
Whereas, you know, you needed to identify the problems of the ordinary Pakistani and to devise solutions for them. Now, I will give you just one example. Why is it that even in India today, you take a state like UP, that they have rates of illiteracy which defy imagination? It's that, you know, the people who decide whether things are going to get done then do not follow up. So you end up in parts of India and Pakistan where there are simply no schools for people to go to. And so this, you know, this kind of investment which delivers results after 10 years has never had the importance that it should have had.
So then can I summarize it like this, that perhaps it's a fact, and this is what I feel, that perhaps it's a fact that we have never really reformed the colonial state. We still have a bureaucracy from the 19th century. We still have a land tenure from the 19th century. We still have a police system from the 19th century. Our constitution is copied from the Government of India Act 1935. In a sense, a society remains stuck in the colonial era. Would you agree with that, or would you disagree?
I couldn't agree with you more, Nadeem.
Okay.
You have summarized it far better than I could have.
Then let me ask you a follow-up question. If that is the case, then Shahid, how can we absolve both yourself and myself? By that I mean not just you and me personally, but our professional, our academic community. Our academic community, for example, when it discusses academic economics, or when it discusses Pakistani economics, I find that they are discussing mainly things like, let's discuss a fiscal deficit, let's discuss export-led growth, let's discuss, you know, some sector, education sector, let's discuss health sector. They discuss everything under the sun and they throw 10,000 figures at you. They'll throw figure after figure after figure at you. But the one thing they don't talk about is the colonial legacy.
Absolutely.
So would you say that there's an intellectual vacuum here? Because quite frankly, I see the politicians sometimes turning to the intellectuals, like they get people into the government. I myself was hired for 3 years. There's plenty of academics who've gone into government. I would say, in fact, there have been more academic finance ministers than political finance ministers in Pakistan. And
absolutely.
And yet, policy has not addressed this issue.
I... You know, Nadeem, you have hit the nail on the head. It's, you know, you look at, I mean, you know, the only serious development economics journal in Pakistan is the Pakistan Development Review. Mm-hmm. You can look at all the articles that have been published mm-hmm. over the last 30 years mm-hmm. or 40 years, mm-hmm. and you will not find a single article which addresses your concerns.
No, that I will disagree with, because I did put out, I ran the journal for a year or so, and I tried to do three or four symposiums in there to bring this out. But unfortunately, our academic community doesn't pick it up.
I don't know. You see, now this is a problem that, people, I think, such as yourself have to answer. You see, the thing is that economics itself, if you do economics in the way that it became a branch of applied mathematics, that is supposed to be the economics with rigor, with analysis, and so on. But if you deal with political economy issues, people will come back to you and say that, you know, actually these things can't be measured, so there is no rigor in your analysis.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the reasons is that you can't get a PhD with this kind of discussion on the political economy.
Fair point. But look, there's another problem. I don't know whether you saw this or not. When I was in the Planning Commission, I prepared a framework of economic growth. I tried to change the planning paradigm. And I put out that framework of economic growth, which was passed by the National Economic Council, the Parliament, and the Cabinet. But I guess nobody really read it. Let me be frank. Nobody read it. I have yet to meet anybody who read it, right?
So there you are.
I go to the Civil Service Academy, they didn't read it. I go to the Staff College, they didn't read it. I go to all the economists in Pakistan, who are your friends and my friends. We know them personally. None of them ever read that. Now, in that, let me tell you, what I put in is very simple. I said the first reform we need, first of all, we don't need many reforms. Secondly, we don't need any of these large things like measuring poverty and measuring education. I said, no. What we need is four fundamental reforms, and then everything will fall into place. And I did it based on an analysis called complexity. We can go into that. I've just written a book on that too. I hope you read it.
Yeah. But that's I haven't read your book, but I've read a review and I want to read your book.
Please do.
I get hold of it. Yeah.
So now the point is, what I tried to say was, look, guys, if you do this kind of analysis, the four reforms that are necessary, and those reforms are, one is we do a government reform, civil service and parliamentary reform, or constitutional reform. The second thing is we do a market reform, we create competitive markets. The third reform is we do an urban reform, because urban areas are where huge productivity increases can take place. The fourth area is we do social capital reform, and, you know, I flesh those things out. The donors came to me and said, we don't like this. I said, why not? Because it doesn't have a chapter on women and the poor and this, that, etc. I said, you must try and understand. All these problems, what I used to say was, Pakistan has a software problem. We've developed a lot of hardware, but we don't have software. Like, for example, we've got roads and we've got railways, we've got everything, but we don't know how to run them. We've got electricity, we don't know how to run it. We've got 180 universities, we don't know how to run them. So I said, we need to fix our software. That means a management problem, which is the government. We have to fix that. Now, the thing is, when I did all this, who did I get pushback from? First, the donors. Donors said, hey, where's the money? You don't have a medium-term framework. You don't have this. You don't want money from us. I said, look, I think my reform will give me money. And I can give you, I give them many examples. The reform will give me money. I don't need money from you. They were very upset. They opposed it. Second things, our economist friends opposed it, because they said, hey, we are consulting with the donors. Donors are giving us money. So we need money from the donors. So we won't. Even today, if you look at what's being written, they are all writing the same old report. Just now, for example, I've got some friend of mine who called me up and said, hey, the World Bank wants to do a project to look at the economic consequences of CPEC, which hasn't even happened, and they want to do that.
They are
going to pay World Bank, because I did a book which is like, it's called Pakistan in the Year 2050. The World Bank is now doing a project called Pakistan at 100, and they're spending millions of dollars doing it. So I told them, I said, guys, I've done this for free for you. Why don't you take this? They said, no, we have to hire 20 consultants to do this.
Yes.
Right? Now, everybody is doing a speculative study from the World Bank. They're trying to give it academic rigor, which they can't, because
you and I
both know, I've studied with 10 Nobel Prize winners, including Robert Lucas, Jim Heckman. They told me you can't even predict 3 months, even on 30 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So the point is, when you have this kind of a situation, What do you do? And we don't make our own policy. I'm afraid when I was in the Planning Commission, I didn't make my own policy. Because the donors pushed back, the donors are making all the policies in Pakistan. And they hate my saying it, but that's a fact. So how do we deal with the situation? We don't have the freedom to make a policy anymore.
You know, Nadeem, even if you were not dependent on foreign resources, you would have a huge struggle on your hands. You have to convince the Nawaz Sharifs and the Imran Khans and so on to your way of thinking. And do you think that that is possible? Because if you think that that is possible, and it is possible within a realistic time span, then half the battle has been won.
No, it is not possible.
But can you get
I'll tell you,
to the Nawaz?
I'll tell you another reason why it's not possible. Because we still have the colonial mentality that any old white consultant is better than anybody from home. I could be a Nobel Prize winner, but the white consultant will come along and speak will be better. Besides, the guy comes with money. Because there's so much money that he brings. So we've got a huge problem. For example, when I said, guys, I don't want to build this or build that. I want to get the reform done. I lost the battle because everybody had a window to the prime minister. I didn't, right? Even though I was a minister in the government. So there is a fundamental problem. All I'm trying to draw your attention to is the fundamental problem in our governance structures, which we have to solve. And that's where I think the rub might be. And your analysis is leading you there too. That unless we can bring the 19th century colonial social infrastructure, governance infrastructure, I should say, the governance infrastructure, which means the civil service, the legal and judicial system, the legal framework, and the politics, which is all sitting in the 19th century, including, I would say, not just that, they are also living in the colonial mansions. They also live in the colonial mansions. They live in colonial style with the chaprasis, with the same bearers, with the same everything. And
you know, the way they look at the world is as if they were still
in that. They still use Shahid. They still use Fitewali file. You know those files with reams upon reams of paper, you open the nala and then you close it, etc. They still don't use email. They still don't use modern lines of communication. Right? So when you have this thing, we don't even want to come into the 20th century for that. So what do you expect? Yeah. And that's a problem. But I would urge you to think about it. The problem lies with us because we're not leading them. We're giving them false reports and making them feel comfort that, okay, it's okay, you can retain the system just so long as you fix the education system.
Absolutely. Huh? And you know, once you fix your education system, you can have that kind of transformative change in less than 10 years.
No, but Shahid, I would argue you can't fix the education system. This is what I was saying. You can't fix the education system with this Babugiri.
You should have fixed the education system in the 1950s.
No, but you can't. I'll tell you why. I'll give you a reason just now, very quickly. Do you know how they appoint vice chancellors in universities? Let me tell you. Secretary Higher Education, who's a grade 20 official in Punjab. That means maybe in his 40s, right? Or maybe late 30s, early 40s. He puts out an ad saying 10 universities need a vice chancellor.
Right.
And you need a PhD, 10 years, this, that, etc., etc. He'll put in those things. And you and I and 20 others, 50 others, 70 others, 100 others will apply. Right? He'll constitute a board. He'll call me, you, five other people. Their favorite is Babar Ali. Babar Ali is on every committee, right?
Yeah.
And in Frontier, Tawar Rahman is on every committee, right? I don't mean to badmouth those. These guys are there. This is a fact. But they've been there for 10 years now. Babar Ali has been there for 10 years. Tawar Rahman has been there for 5 years on this committees, right? And then they have five or six other people. Then they call all these guys into one interview where they will come in for 5 minutes and they'll interview these people. They haven't even seen their names, whatever. They'll interview them and they'll say, will you go to Faisalabad? Will you go to Peshawar? Will you go to Quetta? Will you go to this? And they post five or six vice chancellors together. Right?
Right.
But is that modern day era or is that 19th century?
I mean, that is then maybe even further back than the 19th century.
And they, you can't even that is not a point because the appointment has to go to the chief minister or the prime minister will be ratified.
Yes.
You can't appoint anybody anywhere without the chief minister, prime minister saying yes. So this is so colonial, and the Secretary of Higher Education thinks he's running the ministry, the universities, and the Secretary of Health thinks he's running hospitals. Now, hey, yeah. I don't think you can fix education and health without fixing the bureaucracy.
So, I mean, you know, the $64,000 question is that, you know, where do you start if you want a program of realistic...
Good point, yeah. Where do you think we should start?
Education. That's because, you know, that's the only thing which actually will deliver enough in terms of change in the way we look at the world, and will create a kind of sort of, you know, a semi-skilled workforce.
But let me give you the catch-22. The catch-22 is the education system is in control of the bureaucrats. They will never let it be
Absolutely.
Fixed. So we've got a problem. How will we fix it if nobody will let it be fixed? For example, I'll tell you, I mean, if you try, whoever tries to get a professorship at a local university, we can't.
No.
Right? So how do you fix the education system? Right, they've got a system which is self-defeating, which is going down, not going up, and we can't reform it. So how do you fix it? That's the problem. So my take on this, I'll just give you my take, and then you can say, what I put in my book is that look, unless the academia, unless the thinkers begin to think anew, and begin to put a fresh model, develop fresh debates, develop fresh ideas, especially about dismantling the colonial system, and go into the entrails of how we dismantle the colonial system, not just dismantle it, sorry, but to renew it into the 21st century, to reform it into the 21st century.
Yeah.
We will never go anywhere. Now, you are absolutely right when you said that unfortunately, you will look through the literature, you will not even find one or two decent studies on the civil service reform. Hardly Absolutely. Any studies on judicial reform, hardly any studies on police reform. Whereas we need, I keep telling people, the donors are commissioning 20,000 studies on measuring education, on measuring poverty, on God knows how many stupid things, social effects of this and BISP, etc. But there is not a single study on any of these important subjects like civil service reform, police reform, judicial reform, legal reform, etc. We need a real big debate on this. Because right now, I won't even know where to go. I've been approached by many of these people. I don't even know what to say because, hey, I've got some ideas, but that's not good enough. We need a debate. We need to congeal the ideas. We need to make them better. Yeah. And that debate has not taken place, but unfortunately, there's nowhere for the debate to take place too.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So anyway, so what do you think? I mean, where do you think we can go? What's your final thoughts on this?
My final thoughts are... by the way, don't take them as humor, because my final thoughts, I've often thought about this. And, you know, when people ask me, what are your final thoughts or how should Pakistan go from A to B or A to whatever? I say that, you know, somewhere along, whoever the decision makers are, whether it's the politicians or the army people or retired or whoever, for want of another expression, the elite, the decision-making elite, you have to sit down in the way Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk sat down. And they decided that, you know, we have to solve this problem. You can't just push it down the road and hope that something will turn up and this will be resolved. So Nelson Mandela compromised, and F.W. de Klerk realized that apartheid can't go on. They can have a civil war on their hands for 20, 30, 40 years. But they decided that, you know, this is no time to start fighting with the black population. So you need two patriots to sit down and decide that we can't go on like this. That's my...
Sadly, no, I won't laugh. I will feel very sad because I think you're right. But unfortunately, I don't see any such leadership anywhere around Pakistan. In fact, my sort of sadness lies in the fact that Shahid, I can't even think of a handful of people who can even have a decent conversation like we are talking, and who can even try and talk in an informed fashion about these things. And because of that, I think quite frankly we suffer a lot. Every day you watch television, you are full of despair. What the hell is happening in this country? Right.
I completely agree with you.
And I'm like you, I'm fond of these things, so I go to lots of universities to give talks on this, and you, I know you did a talk in Government College and many places too, LSE and LUMS, I think. But I don't know what your impression was. I come out very sadly disappointed, unfortunately.
Yeah, I did. I mean, there were,
Did you find that the conversation was energizing? Did you find that people were curious? Did you find people asked good questions?
I'm sorry, they were not.
That's a problem. People don't push back. They don't think, and they think that the only thing. I mean, for example, lots of kids. I mean, now you probably know that I spent a lot of my time in my early years. I did a lot of hard mathematical papers and lots of econometrics, etc. But now I find people are using econometrics just to hide behind it, not to ask good questions, but to just throw data because it. And I keep telling them, look, in my day, econometrics was difficult because we had to do everything by hand and from scratch. Now there are canned packages. Yep. You can run any number of things in many number of different ways. So econometrics is not as sexy as it used to be. The more important thing is to think of the question that you're using and why you're using it. But unfortunately, that we don't have. And I go to all these conferences and I'm quite disappointed. So I think the intellectual leadership has a long way to go.
It has. It has. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So
anyway, Shahid, any last-minute thoughts?
I said that you need an epiphany moment. Prime Minister, chief ministers have to wake up one morning and say that enough is enough and we have to do something.
Good.
That's
excellent. Let me just say that please keep writing, please keep doing things, please go, generate a debate. Maybe someday we might have think tanks and thinking people here, so they might listen to people like you.
And I wish you the same because you are there in Pakistan and you have the hands on the pulse. I think you can sense what is going on around you far better than people like us who decided to live abroad.
I don't make that distinction at all. I think quite frankly, all of us are motivated by the same thing. All of us have something to give and we should all give. And this stupid debate that we have here that people here are better than people out there, this is absolute hogwash and we shouldn't buy it. I think everybody has something to give and we should all give if we can. Now in closing, Shahid, let me ask you a question that I always ask people. Would you recommend what sort of a book, movie, whatever you like? Because I feel that I'm pitching this to mostly students or thinking people. So I think they could benefit from you. What book, movie, document, whatever you like. What would you recommend that people go and look at that motivates you, that makes you think?
You know, I came across a book by a man called Joe Studwell. Mm-hmm. It came out, I think, about 3 or 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's called How Asia Works.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it was described by the Financial Times reviewer as this man has busted many myths about development. Mm-hmm. So, and it encompasses a lot of the kinds of things that we've been talking about today.
Okay.
So
okay.
Land Great. Reform, this, that, education. So mm-hmm. I would urge people to get hold of this book.
I'm going to look at it myself. That's lovely. Joe Studwell, How Asia Works. Okay, great. Thank you, Shahid. Thanks for the conversation.
And thank you very much, Nadeem, for giving me this opportunity. Thank you.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem Ul Haq hai.
Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.